Messenger of the Lord. Chapter 28. Reviewing a Century of Health Reform Principles. The health and lifespan advantages of the Seventh-day Adventist Church have been traced to the way they live and eat. Since the 1800s, Seventh-day Adventists have practiced 8 secrets of health that reduce their risk of heart disease and cancer, the 2 leading causes of premature death. By keeping these 2 killers at bay, Seventh-day Adventists enjoy greater health and a longer life than the general population. The scientific confirmation has just been available in recent years, so how did they know before the scientists? From a woman named Ellen G. White. This visionary said God did not want people to suffer unnecessary illness and death, and he inspired her to tell people how they could enjoy maximum wellness. Ellen G. White wrote with amazing simplicity and accuracy what has since been proved to be the best formula for health and longevity. In reviewing Ellen White's health reform principles, readers should first place themselves in the middle of the 19th century. Without any more information about the future than the prevailing notions that governed medical practice at that time, think of how strange the unfolding, synthesizing, integrating health principles of Ellen White must have seemed. Of course, some of these principles had been promoted by contemporaries, but in no place were they so complete or so integrated. No other writers were so free from those errors that subsequent research contradicted. For the average person, even for physicians, in the middle of the 19th century, the germ theory was unheard of. Physicians were still using opium, calomel, mercury, arsenic, and strychnine to heal disease. Aspirin was unknown, along with the X-ray machine, antibiotics, pasteurization, immunizations, and blood transfusions. People generally saw no connection between their lifestyle and disease. Fresh air in the home, night or day, aroused qualms for fear of catching a cold or being bitten by an invasion of flies or mosquitoes. People seldom bathed. Headlines shouting the deteriorating impact of high-fat, low-fiber diets, and the sheer necessity of exercise were a century away. The profound linkage between the mind and body seemed far-fetched. Birth defects due to drugs and alcohol were not to be understood for another 100 years. The concept of cancer germs was a thought that was cross-grained with the medical world. Prenatal influences were considered of little importance. In many of these areas, as recently as a few decades ago, Ellen White seemed not only extreme but even fanatical. Imagine how she could have been viewed in 1863. The record is in, however. Those who believed in her role as God's messenger, those who faithfully put her health principles into practice, became healthier, stronger, more productive people. To the extent that people picked and chose which principles they would incorporate into their lifestyle, to that extent they fell short of reaching their full potential. Dietary aspects of health reform. Has anyone ever become sick or sicker by following these health principles? Have the health reform principles advocated by Ellen White proved to be unfounded or dangerous? Yeast germ in bread. Ellen White penned that bread should be thoroughly baked that, so far as possible, the yeast germs shall be destroyed. She was scoffed at for this statement, even as late as the 1940s. For years, popular magazines advocated eating a cake of live yeast daily. We now know that live yeast cells take up B vitamins from the food material in the intestine, thus making them unavailable for the body. Butter. In 1870, Ellen White wrote that, from principle, she had discarded the use of meat, butter, mince pies, spices, and lard. In 1903, she stated that, as for myself, I have settled the butter question. I do not use it. Health principles, for Ellen White, guided one's plan of life in determining what the best choice should be under all circumstances. At times, in the absence of the best, we must settle for the good. Here again we see her principle of progressive diet reform. Let the people be taught how to prepare food without the use of milk or butter. Further suggestions included. Butter is less harmful when eaten on cold bread than when used in cooking. When properly prepared, olives, like nuts, supply the place of butter and flesh meats. What's bad about butter? 2 basic problems. Disease and health factors relating to fat and cholesterol in the diet. Regarding disease, in the late 1800s, butter was often rancid, a mixture of casein and water, or of calcium, gypsum, gelatin fat, sick, and mashed potatoes. Referring to the future, Ellen White wrote, "Tell them that the time will soon come when there will be no safety in using eggs, milk, cream, or butter, because disease in animals is increasing." Apart from the danger of disease, butter is almost pure fat. It has many of the long-chain saturated fatty acids that tend to increase serum cholesterol, as well as short-chain fatty acids which do not cause the problem. 1 tablespoon of butter contains 33 milligrams of saturated fats and cholesterol. The American Heart Association stated on May 13, 1994, because butter is rich in both saturated fat and cholesterol, it is potentially a highly atherogenic food, causing hardening of the arteries. Most margarine is made from vegetable fat and provides no dietary cholesterol. The more liquid the margarine, i.e., tub or liquid forms, the less hydrogenated it is and the less trans fatty acids it contains. Therefore, though still high in fat, margarine is a preferable substitute for butter, and soft margarines are better than hard ones. Dietary fiber. Ellen White warned that fine flour bread cannot impart to the system the nourishment that you will find in the unbolted wheat bread. The common use of bolted wheat bread cannot keep the system in a healthy condition. The body needs 2 major types of fiber in the diet. Soluble fiber helps to lower serum cholesterol and triglyceride levels. The best sources are oats, beans, apples, barley, and buckwheat. Thus, these foods help reduce the risk of a heart attack. Insoluble fiber can be found in wheat bran, which reduces the risk of colon cancer. Foods high in fiber help to reduce the risk of carcinogenic agents in the intestines. The fiber attaches to the cholesterol and bile acids that have been secreted by the gallbladder and removes them from the intestinal tract rapidly. Animal products have little or no fiber. Refined grains and other refined products have very little. In an Adventist health study, men who often ate whole wheat bread had only 56% of the expected non-fatal heart attack rate and 89% of the expected fatal heart attack rate. Numerous recent studies relate the risk of colon cancer to the lack of fiber in the diet. Gastrointestinal transit time is 77 hours when on a refined diet, but 35 hours on an unrefined diet. Populations on a refined diet have a higher incidence of colon cancer than in countries where most are on an unrefined diet. Colon cancer risk decreases as the fiber in the diet increases. Experts such as Dr. D. P. Burkett, world-renowned British surgeon and medical researcher, state that a lack of dietary fiber is a major cause of appendicitis, varicose veins, diverticulosis, colon cancer, hiatal hernias, constipation, and other health problems. Flesh foods. In 1866, Ellen White wrote that the liability to take disease is increased tenfold by meat eating. Further, in 1869, she said that meat should not be placed before our children. Why was she so explicit? Because the practice of meat eating is detrimental to physical, mental, and spiritual health. Physical impact. Ellen White wrote that meat eating increases the liability to disease tenfold. Further, it causes obesity, sudden death, heart attack or stroke, unwholesome condition of bones, probably osteoporosis, and cancer. Contrary to conventional thinking, she called it a mistake to suppose that muscular strength depends on the use of animal food. The needs of the system can be better supplied, and more vigorous health can be enjoyed without its use. In addition, the use of the flesh of animals tends to cause a grossness, obesity of body. Mental impact. She cautioned that students would accomplish much more in their studies if they never tasted meat. When the animal part of the human agent is strengthened by meat eating, the intellectual powers diminish proportionately. Spiritual impact. Even more important than the physical and mental liabilities of meat eating is the fact that the religious life can be more successfully gained and maintained if meat is discarded, for this diet stimulates into intense activity lustful propensities and enfeebles the moral and spiritual nature. For Ellen White, diet reform is progressive. For this reason, she said frequently that she never felt it her duty to say that no one should taste of meat under any circumstances. To say this when the people have been educated to live on flesh to so great an extent would be carrying matters to extreme. At the same time, she did not soften her words when eternal issues were at stake. In the context of those who were proclaiming the messages of the three angels, Rev 14, and thus were preparing for Christ's return, she said, among those who are waiting for the coming of the Lord, meat eating will eventually be done away. Flesh will cease to form a part of their diet. Meat eating will be eliminated. Before his people can stand before him a perfected people. Ellen White spoke directly to church leaders regarding meat eating. No one should be a teacher of the people who, by teaching or example, contradicts the principles of health reform. Physicians who use flesh meat and prescribe it for their patients should not be employed in our institutions. Ministers who eat meat set an evil example and make it difficult for others to have confidence in them. What scientific research indicates regarding a meat diet? Meat and obesity. It is difficult to become obese when following humanity's original diet, Genesis 1-3, fruits, grains, nuts, and vegetables. Recent studies indicate that those who eat a meat diet are much more likely to be obese. In the Adventist Mortality Study, 16% of vegetarian women and 8% of men were obese, whereas in the non-vegetarian Adventist group, 32% of the women and 20% of the men were obese. Because meat is high in fat, it contains many calories in a small space and is thus a high caloric density food. Meat, obesity, and cancer. But obesity leads to further liabilities. Obesity increases the risk of coronary heart disease by 50 to 100%, and the correlation with the risk of cancer increases dramatically. Obesity increases the risk of cancers such as breast cancer, endometrial cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, and other cancers. People who eat high-fat diets tend to be heavier and to eat more meat and fewer fruits and vegetables, so their risk of cancer also is increasing. In Hiroshima, Japan, breast cancer was 3.8 times greater in people consuming meat daily compared to vegetarians. Daily users of eggs had 2.8 times greater risk, and butter and cheese users 2 to 3 times greater risk than non-consumers of these items. In a study of 265,118 Japanese, meat eaters had 2.5 times greater risk of pancreatic cancer. Immune system. The human immune system is directly affected by what one eats, and thus the body's resistance to cancer may be the most important factor in preventing cancer. Excesses or deficiencies of any nutrient adversely affects the immune system. For example, a high-protein diet depresses T lymphocyte cells, and an unreasonably low-protein diet, as in kwashiorkor, depresses the immune system. Obesity depresses the immune system, as does starvation. A high serum cholesterol depresses the immune system, as do excess doses of vitamin C or E. Meat and cancer. The mortality ratio involving ovarian cancer is distinctly different between A. Adventist lacto-ovo-vegetarians, 15.9/100,000, B. those using meat 1 to 3 times a week, 18/100,000, C. the general population of California, 24/100,000, and D. Adventists using meat 4 or more times weekly, 26.4/100,000. In that same study comparing the three groups, the mortality ratios for breast cancer were A. 64/100,000, B. 73.3/100,000, and C. 81.6/100,000. Animal products increase death risk. Heavy consumers of animal products, meat, milk, eggs, cheese, had a 3.6 times greater risk of death from prostate cancer compared to low consumers. The study also reported that those who eat meat more than 3 times a week increase their risk of fatal or near-fatal bladder cancer. Eating meat 5 or more times a week may triple the risk of coronary heart disease for a 40-year-old male. The American Cancer Society's 1996 report emphasized that diets high in foods from plant sources, vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, have been associated with a decreased risk, whereas diets high in fat and red meat have been associated with an increased risk of colorectal cancer. Further, intake of animal fat, red meats, and dairy products has been found to be associated with an increase in the risk of prostate cancer. Dietary patterns in 15 countries were compared with lymphoma death rates. A positive correlation existed between beef and all animal protein, fish being an exception. Vegetable protein foods were negatively correlated. Seventh-day Adventists in the United States consume as much fat as the general population. Yet, Adventists have only half as many cancers, even cancers not related to tobacco and alcohol. The explanation apparently lies in the difference in the kind of fat consumed. The National Research Council stated that cancer is most closely related to total fat and saturated fat, meat and cancer germs. When Ellen White wrote that, tuberculosis, cancer, and other fatal diseases are caused by tuberculosis and cancerous germs, the medical world scoffed and continued to do so for many decades. But not today. In 1974, milk from leukemic cows was fed to 6 chimpanzees. 2 died with leukemia at 9 months of age, demonstrating that cancer viruses can be transmitted, even between different species. The chicken leucosis virus can be found in 5 to 10% of all eggs, meat, and diabetes. In the Adventist Health Study, those who consumed meat 6 or more days a week had a 3.8 times greater risk than vegetarians of dying of diabetes. Meat and endurance. A 3-day, high-carbohydrate diet, such as the original diet, produced almost 3 times the endurance, 167 minutes, as the 3-day, high-protein, fat diet, 57 minutes, in a study of Swedish athletes. Meat and essential fatty acids. God's original diet contained no animal fat but had sufficient essential polyunsaturated fatty acids from plant sources. Adequate linoleic acid, found in grains, reduces hypertension, high blood pressure, and platelet stickiness. And the aggregation of red blood cells lowers blood cholesterol and reduces the risk of heart attacks and ventricular fibrillation. Meat and longevity. Non-meat eaters have an increased life expectancy beyond 80 years, although there does not appear to be an increase in maximal lifespan. Salt. Although Ellen White stated that salt was essential for the blood, she also advised against using an undue amount of salt. Further, a free use of salt, as well as sugar and milk, is positively injurious. Tea and coffee. For Ellen White, using tea and coffee as a beverage is a sin, an injurious indulgence. After the immediate stimulating effect, a feeling of depression sets in. With continual use, the abuser of the nervous system will experience headaches, wakefulness, palpitation of the heart, indigestion, trembling, and many other evils, for they, tea, coffee, and many other popular drinks, wear away the life forces. Both tea and coffee are poisonous, and Christians should let them alone. A position validated in current research. Caffeine, a major culprit in tea and coffee, is easily available in many popular drinks, cola drinks, and over-the-counter medications. Physiological effects of caffeine are apparent in adults at doses of only 100 to 200 mg, the equivalent of 1 to 3 cups of coffee. But for a child, age 1 to 5, 1 can of caffeinated soda is equal to 4 cups of coffee. The Adventist Health Study found that the use of even 1 cup of coffee daily was associated with a 33% increase in the risk of fatal heart disease in men. Adventists who use 2 or more cups of coffee daily are reported to have a greater risk of fatal colon and bladder cancer. The caffeine syndrome is recognized by aggressiveness, hyperactivity, and sometimes psychotic behavior. Caffeine and the excess ingestion of xanthine alkaloids found in coffee, tea, cocoa, and some popular beverages affect people differently, usually observed in the abnormal stimulation of the nervous system and the inflammation of the gastrointestinal tract. Humanity's original diet. Original diet. Ellen White's simple, positive statement regarding the best diet for human beings has stood the test of time and research. In order to know what are the best foods, we must study God's original plan for man's diet. Grains, fruits, nuts, and vegetables constitute the diet chosen for us by our Creator. The affirming research is voluminous and growing yearly. Nuts. Although the scientific community has long ignored nuts, or thought them too high in fat to be recommended, evidence now substantiates Ellen White's teachings. She included them in the diet chosen for us by our Creator. Further, she said that some nuts are not as wholesome as others. Almonds are preferable to peanuts. Aware of some of the dangers of too many nuts in the diet, because of their high fat content, she warned that too large a quantity of nut food is an injury, but all can eat freely of fruit. In the Adventist Health Study, men who ate nuts 4 to 5 times a week had only half as many fatal heart attacks as those who rarely ate nuts. Walnuts and almonds have been shown to lower serum lipids, reducing risk of atherosclerosis. Fruits and vegetables. Recent research has focused on the health benefits of a diet rich in vegetables and fruits. Vegetables and fruits are complex foods containing more than 100 beneficial vitamins, minerals, fiber, and other substances. Scientists do not yet know which of the nutrients or other substances in fruits and vegetables may be protective against cancer. The principal possibilities include specific vitamins and minerals, fiber, and phytochemicals, carotenoids, flavonoids, terpenes, sterols, indoles, and phenols that are present in foods of plant origin. Until more is known about specific food components, the best advice is to eat 5 or more servings of fruits and vegetables each day. The Adventist Health Study indicated that vegetarians consume twice as much vitamin A and 4 times as much vitamin C as people in the general population. The antioxidant vitamins A, C, and E may lower the risk of cancer and coronary heart disease. Eating 4 servings of legumes per week decreases risk of pancreatic cancer much more than eating legumes only once a week. Where does one find these antioxidants? In carrots, squash, tomatoes, leafy vegetables, dried fruits, fresh strawberries, melons, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, etc. In a study of elderly people, high consumers of these foods had only 30% of the cancer mortality as that of low consumers. In the 1996 American Cancer Society's report, reference was made to the oxygen-induced damage to tissues that occurs constantly as a result of normal metabolism. Because such damage is associated with increased cancer risk, antioxidant nutrients are thought to protect against cancer. Antioxidant nutrients include vitamin C, vitamin E, selenium, and carotenoids. Studies suggest that people who eat more fruits and vegetables containing these antioxidants have a lower risk for cancer. Those eating cabbage once a week had only 1/3 the risk of colon cancer compared to those who ate it once a month. Those getting adequate vitamin A had only 1/3 the risk of lung cancer compared to those with low intake of vitamin A. Oral and pharyngeal cancer were reduced by 1/2 in those consuming high quantities of fruits and vegetables. Adequate amounts of the antioxidant vitamins A, C, and E have been shown to reduce the risk of cataracts. Those who consumed fewer than 3.5 servings of fruit or vegetables daily had a 5 to 10 times increased risk of cataracts. Foods high in potassium, like oranges, bananas, potatoes, and milk, reduce risk of stroke by as much as 40%. Fruits and vegetables at the same meal. Ellen White counseled that we should avoid eating vegetables and fruit at the same meal. At one meal, use bread and fruit. At the next, bread and vegetables. Whenever possible, Mrs. White followed this practice. I eat the most simple foods, prepared in the most simple way. For months, my principal diet has been vermicelli and canned tomatoes, cooked together. This I eat with sweetback. Then I have also stewed fruit of some kind and sometimes lemon pie. Dried corn, cooked with milk or a little cream, is another dish that I sometimes use. What are the problems when fruit and vegetables are combined? For many with a feeble digestion, the mix will cause distress and inability to put forth mental effort. Some children become fretful and peevish. Ellen White saw in vision the cause of a minister's sickness. I took notice of your diet. You eat too great a variety at one meal. Fruit and vegetables taken at one meal produce acidity of the stomach. Then impurity of the blood results, and the mind is not clear because the digestion is imperfect. Mrs. White advised students to eat fruit and grains rather than vegetables for supper. Let the students have the third meal prepared without vegetables, but with simple, wholesome food, such as fruit and bread. The White family considered vegetables to include peas, beans, potatoes, turnips, parsnips, onions, cabbages, and squashes, although some of these would be classified as fruits botanically. Fruits included tomatoes, apples, pears, peaches, strawberries, raspberries, blackberries, huckleberries, grapes, cranberries, and raisins. Grains, or seeds, included wheat, corn, rye, barley, oatmeal, rice, farina, cornstarch, and the like. Some have wondered about Ellen White's inclusion of tomatoes within the fruit group, but that she did, according to common usage. Olives were an item that could be safely eaten at any meal. Milk. Ellen White's counsel regarding milk has often been misunderstood both by those who freely use it and those who avoid it. On one hand, she clearly says that the time will come when milk of the cows will also be excluded from the diet of God's commandment-keeping people. However, again demonstrating Ellen White's common sense as well as enlightened counsel, she also said that, in her day, as the situation now is, The time to discard or exclude milk had not come. She gave two reasons. The poor were not able to make the dietary adjustment immediately. I cannot say to them, you must not eat eggs or milk or cream. You must use no butter in the preparation of food. The gospel must be preached to the poor, and the time has not yet come to prescribe the strictest diet. Common sense indicated that. Until we can teach them how to prepare health reform foods that are palatable, nourishing, and yet inexpensive, we are not at liberty to present the most advanced propositions regarding health reform diet. Disease in animals was increasing, and for safety, reasons it would be wise to discard milk from the diet. But while counseling that we should prepare for the day when milk will not be safe, she emphasized that milk, or its equivalent, is still part of the most healthful diet. Milk seems to be the most available source of vitamin B12. Without milk, for most people, supplements of B12 may be necessary. Ellen White's common sense also warns against extreme positions. For some, prematurely discarding milk without providing its equivalent may cause sickness, even death. For others, it would be an unwarranted financial hardship to find an equivalent for milk. Her common sense urged her to warn against premature proscriptions that would make some people the arbiters as to what others should be putting on their tables, thus creating a time of trouble beforehand. Above all, we should not allow differences of opinion to create disunion. So, the question remains, when should we discard milk from the diet? In 1901 the time had not yet come. When the time does come, God will reveal it. We should wait, using our best judgment, always with the principle of known duty, leading us individually, waiting until the circumstances demand it, and the Lord prepares the way for it. Grains. Ellen White's emphasis on grains as an essential component of an adequate diet has been unequivocally validated in recent research. Grains such as wheat, rice, oats, barley, and the foods made from them constitute the base of healthful diets as illustrated in the food guide pyramid. Healthful diets contain 6 to 11 standard servings of foods from this group each day. Grains are an important source of many vitamins and minerals such as folate, calcium, and selenium, all of which have been associated with a lower risk of colon cancer. Alcohol affects brain cells. When Ellen White wrote in 1885 that alcoholic beverages destroy reason and life, and in 1905 that such drinking destroys the sensitive nerves of the brain, she sounded like an overzealous temperance orator. But in 1970 research indicated that even the moderate imbiber may incur some loss of irreplaceable brain cells every time he drinks. The only real difference between his loss of brain tissue and that of the heavy drinker is one of degree. The ability to make decisions concerning moral issues begins to slip at very low alcohol intake levels, much below what is considered adequate to lower heart attack risk. Caffeine affects spirituality. Ellen White may not have known that she was many decades ahead of scientific confirmation when she warned that all such stimulants and narcotics as tea, coffee, tobacco, alcohol, and morphine exert a pernicious influence upon moral character. The earlier these hurtful habits are formed, the more firmly will they hold their victim in slavery to lust, and the more certainly will they lower the standard of spirituality. But this truth is reflected in current studies. Researchers, among other findings, note that as coffee drinkers grow older, their coffee consumption increases. On a spiritual plane, this increase in consumption accompanies a decrease in religious involvement. Faulty diet and poor scholarship. In 1884, Ellen White stated that 9/10 of the wickedness among the children of today is caused by intemperance in eating and drinking. 6 years later, she wrote that the diet materially affects the mind and disposition. Today, widespread evidence indicates that there is a correlation between poor diet habits and poor scholarship. Better-fed children get better grades in school. When students with poor grades and poor diets are given nutritionally enriched meals, their grades and other scholastic indicators improve. Non-dietary features of health reform. Objectionable aspects of city living. In 1890, Ellen White spoke of Satan at work, poisoning the atmosphere. In 1902, she predicted that city life will grow more and more objectionable, and a peril of health, with the prevalence of foul air, impure water, impure food, including poisonous gases. She looked to the day when many will move to the country, for wickedness and corruption will increase to such a degree that the very atmosphere of the cities will seem to be polluted. Modern research validates this warning. Beneficial effect of sunlight. Ellen White wrote in 1865 that the atmosphere of rooms that are not exposed to light and air is poisonous because it has not been purified by light and air. Why? Death-producing germs abound in dark, neglected corners, in decaying refuse. Perfect cleanliness, plenty of sunlight, careful attention to sanitation in every detail of the home life are essential to freedom from disease and to the cheerfulness and vigor of the inmates of the home. Exercise and physical health. Exercise directly affects the circulation of the blood. Contrary to conventional medicine in the 19th century, exercise is vital to recovery from most diseases as well as to the prevention of disease. In 1872, Ellen White wrote that, "No exercise can take the place of walking. By it, the circulation of the blood is greatly involved." 2 years earlier, she urged that, "All who can possibly do so ought to walk in the open air every day, summer and winter." Why? The muscles and veins are enabled better to perform their work. There will be increased vitality, which is so necessary to health. In 1905, she gave several reasons why inactivity is a fruitful cause of disease. 1. Slow circulation of the blood. 2. Impurities are not expelled through the skin. 3. Lungs are not fed with fresh air. 4. A double burden rests on the excretory organs. Exercise reduces risk of heart disease. Sedentary people have twice as much risk of heart disease and high blood pressure as physically active people. Even medium levels of physical activity in men protects against strokes. The relative risk of mortality for women ages 50 to 74 was 1/3 less than the most active quartile compared to the least active. Exercise may also reduce the risk of cancer of the colon, prostate, and breast, as well as diabetes. After emphasizing that a person should be moderately active for 30 minutes or more on most days of the week, the American Cancer Society's 1996 report noted that physical activity can help protect against some cancers, either by balancing caloric intake with energy expenditures or by other mechanisms. An imbalance of caloric intake and output can lead to overweight, obesity, and increased risk for cancers at several sites, colon and rectum, prostate, endometrium, breast, among postmenopausal women, and kidney. Exercise may boost the immune system. Exercise and mental ability. Ellen White wrote that physical inaction lessens not only mental but moral power. Exercise linked with the ability to think was noted in a study of 20 persons who exercised 3 times a week for 6 months. Conclusion: they were not only 20% fitter, they also were 70% better at making decisions than before beginning their exercise regimen. A walk after meals. Mrs. White clearly stated that we should not. Adequate sleep. Mrs. White included a program of adequate sleep as part of her 8 natural remedies. After linking mental vigor with physical health, she wrote, "Proper periods of sleep and rest and an abundance of physical exercise are essential to health of body and mind. To rob nature of her hours for rest and recuperation, by allowing one man to do the work of 4, or of 3, or even of 2, will result in irreparable loss." In the Bellick-Bresso study, it was noted that sleeping 7 to 8 hours nightly is one of the health factors that extends life by as much as 11 years. Trust in God. Long before many had linked health with spiritual values, Mrs. White wrote, "Courage, hope, faith, sympathy, love, promote health and prolong life." A strong correlation exists between the mind and the body in physical recovery, even in the program of reversing heart disease. Mrs. White was equally clear about how spiritual values not only help in curing disease, but are perhaps health's greatest safeguard. Literature is abundant that documents how faith and social support from family and friends encourage mental and spiritual well-being. People who attend church regularly have fewer illnesses than non-churchgoers. Non-religious Jews are twice as likely to have a coronary attack as synagogue-attending Jews. Cancer, a virus. On page 322, we discussed Ellen White's instruction regarding dietary factors that may cause cancer. At the time she wrote, eminent men and women of science emphatically declared that cancer was not infectious, that there was no cancer germ. Decades later, in 1956, Wendell Stanley, a PhD virologist and Nobel Prize winner at the University of California, asserted his belief that viruses cause most or all human cancers. He described viruses as midget germs that lurk in the human body for years, even a lifetime. Some cause trouble, some do not. In some cases, the cancer viruses might become active by aging, dietary indiscretions, hormonal imbalance, chemicals, radiation, or a combination of these stresses, and malignancies may follow. Much cancer research has been done since, lending support to Ellen White's reference to cancerous germs, asterisk see note, but currently it is believed that there are other, more common, causes of cancer as well. Dr. Robert J. Huebner, chief of the Laboratory of Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health at Bethesda, Maryland, reported in 1961 that there isn't the slightest doubt in our minds that human cancers are caused by viruses. To this extent, they are simply infectious diseases. Contributing causes of cancer. Associated factors with aging. Note Ellen White's interesting comment in 1864 regarding how aging may affect certain factors that stimulate latent cancer germs. Cancerous humor, bodily fluid, which would lie dormant in the system throughout their lifetime, is inflamed and commences its eating, destructive work. Drugs, referring to a popular treatment for disease in the 19th century, Ellen White declared, "This is the effect of calomel. It inflames the joints and often sends rottenness into the bones. It frequently manifests itself in tumors, ulcers, and cancers years after it has been introduced into the system." Tobacco. In 1864, Mrs. White added her voice to the few in her day who had recognized that tobacco is a poison of the most deceitful and malignant kind, a slow poison. Among the many cancers caused by smoking, lung cancer among ex-servicemen became prevalent in the mid-1930s in the United States as a direct result of heavy smoking during World War I. It takes about 20 years for cancer-producing results to become obvious. Before the 1930s, cancer of the lung was an extremely rare disease. In 1995, in the United States alone, 418,000 deaths were caused by smoking. Unless the present trend is reversed, it is expected that by the year 2025, 10 million people will die annually as a consequence of smoking tobacco. But tobacco smokers also show high death rates from coronary artery disease. Indeed, those who acquire and indulge the unnatural appetite for tobacco do this at the expense of health. Although the major risk factor for lung cancer is tobacco, diet also affects risk. But a greater consumption of vegetables, fruits, or both together has also been associated with a lower risk of lung cancer. Fruits and vegetables reduce cancer risk whether or not people smoke. Parental smoking is a significant factor in their children's health, even their death. Researchers at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin, say that more young children are killed by parental smoking than by all unintentional injuries combined. They attribute 2,800 deaths to low birth weight caused by mothers who smoke during pregnancy. Another 2,000 deaths are due to sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS, caused by secondhand smoke. Another 1,000 are caused by asthma. The same research said that an additional 5.4 million children suffer non-fatal asthma and ear infections triggered by parents smoking, costing an estimated $4.6 billion annually to treat. Further research indicates that pregnant women who smoke more than 10 cigarettes a day run the risk of giving birth to a child who will develop conduct disorder, defined as serious antisocial behavior, for 6 months or more. Boys whose mothers smoked during pregnancy were 4.4 times more likely to engage in antisocial activities, including lying, stealing, arson, vandalism, or cruelty than boys whose mothers did not smoke or smoked fewer than 10 cigarettes a day. Studies suggest that smoking causes changes in a child's brain functioning. Drugs and birth defects. In 1865, Mrs. White linked birth defects with poisonous drugs administered by physicians. In 1890, she warned that thousands, born deaf, blind, diseased, or idiotic, were casualties of their parents' indulgences in alcoholic beverages. Scientific research beginning in the 1950s has validated this warning, including the negative effects of smoking and caffeine consumption on the fetus. During pregnancy even, aspirin should be taken only in small amounts and not over long periods of time. Physical activity for the sick and the convalescent. In the 1860s, bed rest and the rest cure were standard recuperative procedures and remained so into the mid-20th century. Contrary to conventional medical practice, Ellen White declared in 1867 that she had been frequently shown that the sick should be taught that it is wrong to suspend all physical labor in order to regain health. To suspend activity in order to regain health is a great error. 3 years later, if invalids would recover health, they should not discontinue physical exercise, for they will thus increase muscular weakness and general debility. Further, the blood is not enabled to expel the impurities as it would if active circulation were induced by exercise. Mervyn G. Hardinge, M.D., one-time Dean, School of Health, Loma Linda University, reviewed this amazing 180-degree turn in medical practice. The rest cures of the recent past have today given way to programs of occupational and educational therapy, hypnosis and medical practice. Ellen White's condemnation of hypnotism has been supported by many modern psychiatric practitioners and ridiculed by others. In speaking to a physician in 1901, she said, "No man or woman should exercise his or her will to control the senses or reason of another, so that the mind of the person is rendered passively subject to the will of the one who is exercising the control." This science, hypnotherapy, may appear to be something beautiful, but it is a science which you are in no case to handle. Temporary relief may be felt, but the mind of the one thus controlled is never again so strong and reliable. In reference to the use of hypnotism in dentistry, two dentists authored an article entitled "Psychological Evaluation of Hypnosis in Dentistry," in which they concluded, "In a study of the personality characteristics of dentists who employ hypnosis in their practice, the subjects consisted of 34 dentists. The results indicated that most well-adjusted dentists do not tend to use hypnosis. The vast majority of practicing dentists feel it is possible to render adequate service without employing hypnosis. Hypnosis, in general, is not held in high esteem by the dental profession. Dentists who are well-adjusted, who are relatively satisfied with themselves, and who obtain satisfaction from the conventional practice of their profession do not tend to use hypnosis or to become interested in its use. It is as if they do not need such an additional and unusual source of gratification." Mind-body relationships. In 1867, Ellen White linked the sickness of body and mind to nearly all its dissatisfied feelings and discontented repinings. In 1872, she urged physicians to cure the body through the mind, because a great deal of the sickness which afflicts humanity has its origin in the mind and can only be cured by restoring the mind to health. Heart sickness makes many dyspeptics, for mental trouble has a paralyzing influence upon the digestive organs. In 1905, Mrs. White expanded these psychosomatic concepts in noting that disease is sometimes produced and is often greatly aggravated by the imagination. Many die of disease, the cause of which is wholly imaginary. Ancient medical science attested that the mind and body cannot be separated. But this truth has not always been translated into medical practice. In the latter half of the 20th century, medical research generally affirmed not only that health and happiness are intertwined, but that faulty emotional patterns can actually cause disease. In 1993, psychiatrist George F. Solomon, of the University of California at Los Angeles, said, "The mind and body cannot be separated. The mind is the brain, and the brain is part of the body. The brain regulates and influences many physiological functions, including immunity. Mental and physical well-being are inextricably intertwined." Dr. Solomon coined the term psychoimmunology in 1964, a term that was expanded to psychoneuroimmunology, PNI, by Robert Ader. After 25 years of studying the biological mechanisms by which emotions and attitudes affect one's resistance to disease, Solomon said, "We have studied people with a variety of illnesses, and people with very good coping skills tend to have a greater speed of recovery." In 1995, Healing in the Mind, a remarkable book by Bill Moyers based on the television series with the same title, was devoted to two important questions. How do thoughts and feelings influence health? How is healing related to the mind? Author Bill Moyers and his team directed these questions to physicians in large public hospitals and small community clinics. They talked with people in stress reduction clinics and therapeutic support groups. They explored these questions with scientists on the frontier of mind/body research. Their answers were remarkably consistent. The mind controls the body for good or ill. Moyers concluded that, "Talking with different doctors during this journey, I realized that we do need a new medical paradigm that goes beyond body parts medicine, and not only for the patient's sake. At a time when the cost of healthcare is skyrocketing, the potential economic impact of mind-slash-body medicine is considerable. Moyer quoted Eric J. Castle approvingly when Castle wrote that healing powers consist only in and no more than in allowing, causing, or bringing to bear those things or forces for getting better, whatever they may be, that already exist in the patient. Dean Ornish, in an extended interview that flowed from Ornish's groundbreaking research on reversing arteriosclerosis through non-invasive methods such as diet, exercise, and stress reduction, said, "Taking into account cholesterol, blood pressure, smoking, genetics, and all of the other known risk factors still explains only about half of the heart disease we see. Clearly, something else is going on. My clinical experience, as well as what we're showing in our research, suggests that psychological, emotional, and even spiritual factors are important, not only in terms of how they affect our behaviors, like diet and exercise, but also in more direct ways. Electrical currents in brain and nervous system." In 1934, members of the Mayo Clinic staff in Rochester, Minnesota, were discussing the electrical action of the brain. In 1962, Dr. Ernest Weber, president of Polytechnic Institute, Brooklyn, New York, wrote that he knew of no greater modern wonder than the discovery of electromagnetic waves. In 1954, an article in the Scientific American reviewed the developing science of electromagnetic waves. 25 years ago, 1929, Hans Berger, a German psychiatrist, began to publish some strange little pictures consisting of nothing but wavy lines. They should have caused great excitement among his colleagues, because he claimed that they showed the electrical activity of the human brain. But in fact, no one took them seriously. For several years, no one even bothered to repeat his experiments. In the quarter of a century since then, the study of his little wavy lines has grown into a new department of science called electroencephalography. Today, several hundred laboratories in the United States and a similar number in Europe are recording and interpreting charts of the electrical discharges of human brains. Their total annual output of charts would girdle the earth. Ellen White wrote in 1869, "Whatever disturbs the circulation of the electric currents in the nervous system lessens the strength of the vital powers, and the result is a deadening of the sensibilities of the mind." 3 years later, she declared, "This class, physical laborers who use the brain powers very little, fall more readily if attacked by disease. The system is vitalized by the electrical force of the brain to resist disease." In 1903, she added, "The influence of the mind on the body, as well as of the body on the mind, should be emphasized. The electric power of the brain, promoted by mental activity, vitalizes the whole system, and is thus an invaluable aid in resisting disease. This should be made plain. The power of the will and the importance of self-control, both in the preservation and in the recovery of health, the depressing and even ruinous effect of anger, discontent, selfishness, or impurity, and on the other hand, the marvelous life-giving power to be found in cheerfulness, unselfishness, gratitude, should also be shown." Caution in the use of the X-ray. Ellen White not only endorsed the proper use of the X-ray, she permitted X-ray treatment for a black spot on her forehead. But she sounded an early warning about overexposure and X-ray therapy. Speaking in regard to new electrical appliances being installed in the Paradise Valley Sanitarium, she said, "I was instructed that some connected with the institution were introducing things for the treatment of the sick that were not safe. The application of some of these electrical treatments would involve the patient in serious difficulties, imperiling life. I have been instructed that the X-ray is not the great blessing that some suppose it to be. If used unwisely, it may do much harm. The results of some of the electrical treatments are similar to the results of using stimulants. There is a weakness that follows. Through the years, the effects of excessive X-ray radiation in the treatment of disease have become well-known: tissue breakdown with the potential risk of anemia, leukemia, cataract formation, and shortening of life. But when used wisely, the positive results of X-ray diagnostics and treatment are incalculable." Prenatal influences. From 1865 to her last years, Ellen White emphasized the various facets of prenatal influences. Yet, not until the 1950s was this concept given credibility in scientific circles. Since then, a tidal wave of concurrence has flooded the medical world. In 1865, Mrs. White wrote, "The irritability, nervousness, and despondency manifested by the mother will mark the character of her child. In past generations, if mothers had informed themselves in regard to the laws of their being, they would have understood that their constitutional strength, as well as the tone of their morals, and their mental faculties, would in a great measure be represented in their offspring. In 1954, Ashley Montague wrote, "There is now sufficient evidence from many sources to indicate that the unborn child can be variously affected by physical changes in the mother, and that although a woman cannot mark her baby by seeing something unpleasant before he is born, nor make him a poet by reading Keats and Shelley during her pregnancy, there are ways in which she definitely can influence his behavior pattern. It is largely up to her, and to those surrounding her during her pregnancy, whether her infant will be born a happy, healthy, sweet-tempered individual or an ill-adjusted neurotic." Corroborating the research of many, Leland H. Scott wrote in 1967, "There is a growing evidence that chemical irregularities in the mother's blood brought about by endocrine imbalance, dietary deficiencies, or ill health may have serious effects. Maternal malnutrition often results in the unborn child being deprived of essential vitamins or nutrients necessary for its normal growth and health. Childhood abnormalities, such as rickets, nervous instability, epilepsy, and cerebral palsy, have been found to result from serious malnutrition in the mother at certain points during the period of pregnancy. First years of a child's life." Tightly connected with the concept of prenatal influences is the belief that the first few years of a child's life set the life course. In 1881, Ellen White wrote that the parents' work must begin with the child in its infancy. More precisely, parents should properly discipline children during the first 3 years of their lives. Do not allow them to form their wishes and desires. The mother must be mind for her child. The first 3 years is the time in which to bend the tiny twig. In the overall training of the child, in areas beyond discipline, Ellen White is emphatic. Too much importance cannot be placed on the early training of children. The lessons that the child learns during the first 7 years of life have more to do with forming his character than all that it learns in future years. The importance of a child's first 3 years of learning was stressed in 1997 by a White House panel of experts, as reported in the Washington Post. The scientists and child development specialists presented compelling new research showing that a child's language, thinking, and emotional health are largely formed before age 3. Not only are most brain synapses connections between brain cells formed before age 3, the report said, those synapses that have been activated many times by repeated early experience tend to become permanent. The synapses that are not used tend to become eliminated. Modern research confirms health principles. Clive McKay. The late Dr. Clive M. McKay, professor of nutrition at Cornell's New York State College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, where he taught for 37 years 1925-1962, was recognized worldwide as a pioneer and authority in nutritional theory, research, and history. After coming into contact with the health principles of Ellen White through Helen Chin, a 20-year-old Seventh-day Adventist graduate student, he wanted to know more about her church and its health teachings. Eventually, he received counsels on diet and foods at his request. This book, a compilation of Ellen White materials on a healthful diet and its relation to physical, mental, and spiritual health, also dates and lists the source of the various extracts. Since McKay believed that anything written before 1900 was unscientific, he urgently asked Helen, where did she, Ellen White, get her information? Later, Dr. McKay talked to F. D. Nickel, editor of the Review and Herald, about his new interest in Adventist health principles as set forth by Ellen White. Nickel, knowing that the Unitarian scientist probably would not understand the biblical doctrine of spiritual gifts, parried his questions about Ellen White. He told McKay that her critics dismissed her as a plagiarist, copying from contemporaries. Nonsense, McKay responded. I simply cannot accept that explanation. It creates a much bigger problem than it resolves. If she merely copied her contemporaries, how did she know which ideas to borrow and which to reject out of the bewildering array of theories and health teachings current in the 19th century? Most were quite irrational and have now been repudiated. She would have had to be a most amazing person, with knowledge beyond her times, in order to do this successfully. In the years following, McKay gave lectures featuring Ellen White's writings on nutrition to various groups, including scientific bodies. A summation of his findings was published in the Review and Herald. U. S. Department of Agriculture and Health, Education, and Welfare. In July 1980, USDA and HEW issued jointly their Dietary Guidelines for Americans. 1. Eat a variety of foods. 2. Maintain ideal weight. 3. Avoid too much fat, saturated fat, and cholesterol. 4. Eat foods with adequate starch and fiber. 5. Avoid too much sugar. 6. Avoid too much sodium. 7. If you drink alcohol, do so in moderation. This report served as a ringing wake-up call to health workers as it was to the general population. But if this report had been issued in 1863, it would have been as startling as Ellen White's instructions were at that time. In 1995, the same offices issued their updated Dietary Guidelines. National Academy of Sciences, National Research Council. This research-oriented body gave a joint report in June 1982, entitled Diet, Nutrition, and Cancer. Focusing on the connection between diet and cancer, this report was essentially the same as the government report of 1980. Their research indicated that by making changes in one's diet, cancer risk can be greatly reduced. Specifically, they urged eating largely of fruits, whole grains, and vegetables, and reducing consumption of fats, sugar, salt, and alcohol. American Cancer Society. In February 1983, the editor of the Society's journal, Cancer News, published an article entitled, At Last, an Anti-Cancer Diet. The first paragraph pointed to California's Seventh-day Adventists as having a much lower rate of colon/rectal cancer than other Americans. Later in the article, studies were noted that indicated breast, colon, and prostate cancer is significantly lower among people who eat lots of vegetables. This startling finding, says Walter Troll, professor of environmental medicine at New York University, suggests that vegetables contain substances capable of inhibiting cancer in man. Surgeon General of the USA. In July 1988, C. Everett Koop, MD, released the first nutrition report by AUS Surgeon General. Based on more than 2,500 scientific articles, his prescription for America was less fat, more vegetables and fruit. Preventive Medicine Research Institute at the School of Medicine, University of California. In 1990, Dean Ornish, president of this research institute at the University of California, published his findings that arterial blockage built up by cholesterol can be reversed by a largely vegetarian diet plus exercise and stress reduction. His conclusions were backed up by four-color slides of computer-analyzed coronary angiograms and PET, positron emission tomography, scans. After a dramatic study of 6,500 persons at Cornell University in 1990, Ornish wrote a parody on the slogan used by the American Beef Association. Meat. Real food for real death of people. Authority on high blood pressure. Norman M. Kaplan, professor of internal medicine and head of the hypertension section of the Southwestern Medical School, University of Texas, in Dallas, speaking at Loma Linda University to more than 1,000 healthcare professionals, said, You as Adventists may have espoused a certain dietary lifestyle on the basis of faith in the past, but now you can practice it on the basis of scientific evidence. Hopefully you will not go back and join the midstream, but rather adhere to your health heritage. Adventist Mortality Study, 1958, and a joint study with the American Cancer Society, 1960. These California studies compared the cause of death for a large group of Seventh-day Adventist men with a similar number of non-Seventh-day Adventist men. The research does not differentiate between Adventists who eat meat daily, weekly, monthly, or none at all. Neither does it distinguish between lacto-ovo-vegetarians and total vegetarians. Compared with non-Seventh-day Adventist men can expect fewer deaths caused by some form of cancer. For example, according to the results of the mortality study listed below, Adventist men have 20% fewer deaths caused by lung cancer compared to the general population's death rate from lung cancer. Note the percent of fewer deaths expected among all Adventists for other kinds of cancer. 20% lung cancer. 5% mouth, throat, and larynx cancer. 32% bronchitis and emphysema. 28% bladder cancer. 34% esophageal cancer. 13% cirrhosis of the liver. 72% breast cancer. 65% digestive tract cancer, 62% leukemia, 61% ovarian cancer, 54% uterine cancer, 66% other cancer, 53% strokes, 55% diabetes, 42% peptic ulcer, 31% suicides, 59% deaths attributed to all medical causes. The Adventist Incidence Study in 1974, sent to 63,350 Adventist households in California, this questionnaire enumerated 348 variables covering demographic, socioeconomic, and religious belief and practice characteristics, family and personal medical histories, and nutritional, drug use, and exercise patterns. The results continue to bear out the positive health benefits of the Adventist health message set forth by Ellen White a century ago. European studies confirm these two Adventist studies. A Norwegian 17-year study covering all Adventists in that country concluded in 1981 that Norwegian Adventists enjoyed about the same benefits as California Adventists. The study confirmed the observation that neither social groups nor geographic selection explains the health advantage observed among Norwegian Seventh-day Adventists, and that the total lifestyle generally advocated and followed by Seventh-day Adventists explains the observed results. In 1982, Denmark's Cancer Registration Office in Copenhagen reported, after a 35-year study, that only 1 in 10 Adventists developed cancer, whereas the rate for the Danish population was 1 in 4 during the same period. The Cancer Registration's chief medical director said that, without doubt, the Adventists studied in the investigation sustained far less risk of developing cancer than the average person. Their risk was 70 to 80% less than that of the general Danish population. In 1983, a Dutch study reported an 8.9-year life expectancy advantage for Adventist men and a 3.7-year advantage for Adventist women. A Polish study reported in 1985 that Adventist men had an advantage of 9.5 years, and Adventist women a difference of 4.5 years. American Cancer Society Guidelines on Diet, Nutrition, and Cancer Prevention, 1996. Their four basic guidelines were, 1. Choose most of the foods you eat from plant sources. Eat 5 or more servings of fruit and vegetables each day. Eat other foods from plant sources, such as breads, cereals, grain products, rice, pasta, or beans several times each day. 2. Limit your intake of high-fat foods, particularly from animal sources. Choose foods low in fat. Limit consumption of meats, especially high-fat meats. 3. Be physically active, achieve and maintain a healthy weight. Be at least moderately active for 30 minutes or more on most days of the week. Stay within your healthy weight range. 4. Limit consumption of alcoholic beverages, if you drink at all. Summary of Ellen White's Principles of Health Reform. Ellen White's contribution to an advanced understanding of health and disease may be attributed to these factors. 1. Insights received through visions. 2. Her spirit-directed ability to perceive what was in harmony with those insights from the maze of current opinion. And 3. Her governing principle of the great controversy theme that placed health matters within the context of a person's spiritual motivation, commitment, and preparation for the advent. The record stands, compared to the relatively few health reformers in her day, Ellen White was unique. When compared to or contrasted with conventional medical wisdom and practice, she was decades ahead of her time. In what way was Ellen White unique? Contemporary health reformers were prescient in some areas, but gravely wrong in others. Many held extreme positions on discarding milk, sugar, and salt, etc. Others believed that rest, not physical exercise, was indicated for those recuperating from illness. What if Ellen White had held these and other extreme positions? Her credibility would have been severely damaged in the ensuing years. More than that, if she had endorsed contemporary medical knowledge, her credibility would have been demolished. Further, her appeal that she was directed by divine guidance eventually would have been seen as a temporary ploy for self-serving purposes. But the health principles found in her 19th-century writings, distinctively coherent, have stood the test of time. Her principles relating to disease prevention as well as health restoration are not today viewed as fads. They were not the result of a shotgun approach. All of the principles are integrally related. Specifics are seen relating to the whole person's total health. the lifestyle of Seventh-day Adventists is reflected in the phenomenal accumulation of published research papers concerning the Adventist lifestyle. It seems probable that no other religious group has attracted so much recent interest from scientists.